The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Hannah Dillon, staff writer at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by Tom Walters from Billion Dollar Boy. Hi Tom, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us. Delightful to have you here on the podcast. This week, I'm also thrilled to be joined by ExchangeWire's Head of Content, John Still. How are you, John?
Good, man. Thanks very much for having me.
No worries at all. Thank you both so much for joining this week. I'll start with our first story, which is that the Shadow Culture Secretary of the UK, Lucy Powell, has outlined her party's plans for the UK's creative industries. Speaking at the Creative Coalition Festival earlier this month, Powell revealed the Labour Party's Creative Compact plan for the sector, which will focus particularly on design and technology. Powell asserted that a Labour government would make the platform economy work for creatives and small startup businesses, stating that previous governments have failed to harness the technological revolution. The Shadow Culture Secretary said that Labour would use the power of technology to support, not stifle, the work of creatives, and pledged to create a more level playing field by reducing the power of big tech firms with unbreakable monopolies. Investing in developing the creative sector outside of London and the South East and bolstering the UK's global creative reputation will also be addressed by the plan, according to Powell. So, Tom, I'll come to you first on this. Is the UK government doing enough to support the creative sector, in your opinion?
At the moment, no. As we all know, via the many headlines, they have a lot of issues on their plate that they are obviously trying to deal with, and is proving to be a drain when it comes to focus. Those ultimately need to be put to bed so that the government can actually focus on growing the economy and growing the various industries that contribute enormously to the wider growth of the country. And as we know, the creative sectors are a really big part of that. We are a part of the economy that Britain can continue to say that they are world leading in, focus on growing that sector will be very welcome. I think the quote that you mentioned from Lucy Powell about supporting, not stifling, is apt. The creator and creative economy is evolving faster than ever. And the various creatives and businesses within it need support in adapting to that.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's some, in what Lucy's saying, there's certainly some encouragement. In terms of what's being done at the moment, no. I think the current government, there's a lot of hot air that comes out, and they speak a lot. You know, Jeremy Hunt speaks repeatedly about creating a new Silicon Valley in the UK. And then that's his headline, and there's little substance in terms of what's actually done. We've seen Tech Nation lose its funding. I know that was sent elsewhere to Barclays Digital Eagle scheme across the UK, but it's still, it seems a backward move to take that funding from Tech Nation, which has done so much. In terms of this plan that Lucy Powell's put forward, I think there's a lot of good in it. It's nice to see a focus of the Northern Corridor connecting the North. That's one of the downfalls and major criticisms of Tech Nation, was that it took over Tech North and turned it into Silicon Roundabout. Basically, it became very UK focused and focused on procuring overseas funding. And it's good to see that this plan would encourage areas of the country that have a wealth of creative talent and businesses. You know, we've seen Channel 4 and BBC head up north, and it's good to encourage that collaboration between the bigger cities outside of the capital, as much as a lot of good goes on in London. And I say that speaking from the centre of London. I think cities like Liverpool, Manchester, Leeds, Newcastle have so much to offer. So it's good to see that encouragement, and I hope this is, you know, something that becomes part of Labour's manifesto going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the quotes that really stood out to me from this article, well, from Lucy Powell, was that was the promise to reduce the power of big tech firms with unbreakable monopolies. It's quite a big promise. Do you think that Labour's plan does sound like it could fulfil this? Tom, come to you first on that.
I think that the impact that the British government or the shadow minister can have once in power is on these platforms that are these enormous global businesses is relatively muted outside of the EU, frankly. I'd be interested to see how she and the potential Labour government would look at potentially bringing that to life. I think that curtailing those platforms is going to be challenging. I think that the approach of looking at creative ways of supporting the industries and supporting nascent businesses that are their own platforms and are building their own ways of facilitating creative work is probably the smarter way to go for them, for sure.
Any thoughts on this, John?
Yeah, just in terms of kind of that ground-up approach that Tom mentioned, I'd agree. You know, it will be about, as we're seeing a lot across the news at the moment, you know, the powers of big tech are coming into focus. But what's needed is that investment at the grassroots, so the smaller startups, the smaller business can really get a foothold in their industries. I think, you know, Lucy Powell has described tech as a sector that boosts all other sectors. And I like that. I think that's a really nice way of looking at it, because it is, you know, from whether you're e-commerce, whether you're, you know, whatever you rely on for your business, ultimately tech is the foundation for it. I think like that grassroots encouragement is really positive to see. And I'd like to see more really invested into that side of the industry rather than, tax breaks for the tech monopolies.
I think what's also nice to see from this proposal is, you know, the language used really reflects an understanding of the space. And I think that we've seen, you know, whether it be because of the sort of constant changing of ministers or whatever, you know, we've quite frequently seen a complete lack of understanding of our industries and even the correct terminology for various things. I mean, we think about Nadine Dorries talking about downstreaming and things like that. Like, you know, it's nice to see Lucy and her team taking it really seriously and really trying to understand more about our industry and the different parts that can constitute it.
Yeah, agreed on that.
Wonderful. Fantastic. Well, I will take us on to our second story for this week's podcast, one of the biggest stories of this week, which is about Silicon Valley Bank's collapse. So HSBC has acquired Silicon Valley Bank's UK operations for just £1. The deal, which followed a weekend of negotiations by the UK government, Bank of England and HSBC, has saved SVB from insolvency and their customers from significant losses. The Bank of England said that the sale would stabilise SVB UK while restoring confidence in the financial system. HSBC's acquisition will protect the deposits of SVB's 3,500 UK customers, which include a number of tech startups, as well as more established firms like Trustpilot. So huge story this week. John, I'll come to you first on that. What impact do you think the collapse of SVB has had on startups in the UK and beyond?
It's hard to say at the moment. It's obviously been a huge story over the weekend, both in the States and here. It was all that tech could talk about over the weekend. There was a lot of insecurity, a lot of people terrified, I think, in the tech space, given how big and what SVB means to that space. But at the moment, since the HSB acquisition and the federal takeover in the States, it's breathed a sigh of relief, I'd say, a lot of people. You know, those companies have not lost the money that they thought they would. They've had what was in the bank secured. So I think there's a lot of relief that it can be business as usual. For me, where the ripples or the tremors are coming from is faith in the sector, perhaps. And that's not just for banks that fund tech, that's also for banking. We're seeing a couple of things happen, small, you know, not related, but the Credit Suisse the Credit Suisse investment that's had to come today. The faith in the financial sector has taken a little bit of a hit, and I think people are a little bit wary at the moment of where their cash is and what's going to happen. So for me, yeah, we don't know if there has been a huge impact. I am delighted for all the companies that had money invested that they've not lost out and been hit badly by it. But yeah, we don't know ultimately how far the ripples will take it, and we'll be keeping an eye on it for a while, I think.
Yeah. Tom, what do you think? What kind of effect do you think that SVB's collapse could potentially have on emerging tech companies?
I think a big impact. We can talk with some experience here. Billion Dollar Boy is a business that's now 9 years old, but when we started, we banked with SVB. SVB is still a bank that we have an account with. It was a really important partner for us at the beginning of our journey when we set up in the US, because it was the easiest bank with which to set up as a foreign tech and advertising focused business. It's sad, frankly, to see what has been historically a great facilitator of innovation fail in this way. Thankfully, we weren't affected by the recent situation, as there were changes in the way that we were approaching that from a financial point of view several years ago. But you know, you can see how it would have impacted enormously a lot of businesses, and I think obviously that is, you know, still the ripple effect of access to funds will be impacting a lot of businesses, but not only that, the you know, the ability to innovate and move quickly, especially as a foreign business going into the US, I think is going to be quite significant.
I know it's still a developing situation, but do you think that this would certainly knock the confidence of a lot of startups emerging at this point?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I guess that the environment in the UK is quite different, in that the kind of access to innovative financial products and innovative banking is a lot easier than in the US, for example, where things are still quite traditional. Certainly, it will be knocking the confidence of a lot of people, startups included, but also those looking to invest. And a lot of innovation over the last however many years has come from that kind of promise of being profitable at some point. And the level of risk that people are willing to take on both sides will be a lot lower now than it was just a week ago.
John, any thoughts on this?
It's interesting, honestly, to hear Tom's own experience with them, and that the ease of facilitation, I suppose, and the fact that they were a bank that would take on companies looking to innovate, and it was an easier system for them. So yeah, agreed with Tom that in that case, it's a sad thing that has happened, it's like I said before, I think just the faith in the system that might be slightly shaken, that's going to be the initial ripple effect and the official impact that's had. A story to keep an eye on, I think, just to see how it develops, and to see, you know, we saw some pretty swift action from both the US side and then from HSBC making the quick acquisition. Good to see how that shakes out.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's certainly one to keep an eye on as things develop. I'll take us on to our final story for this week, which is that Spotify has unveiled a new design for the home screen of its app. The new look will feature more vertical scrolling and visual content, giving the audio streamer a far closer resemblance to TikTok and Instagram in an attempt to boost discoverability on the platform. The move is reflective of Spotify's ambition over recent years to become a host of more diverse and profitable content, which has seen them shift away from the music streaming that they became almost synonymous with. As one commentator notes, the push to get users to explore new things is all the more important given the firm's significant investment in podcasting, which is yet to pay dividends. I'll come to you first on this, Tom. Do you think that Spotify is making the right move in trying to emulate other platforms, or do you think doing so might backfire?
I think they need to innovate. I think everyone would make that argument. I don't know actually quite how old Spotify is at the moment, but I remember when I first made an account, I think 2010 or maybe slightly earlier, and it's still not profitable. So they need to do something about that. Obviously, we know that tech funding for unprofitable businesses is drying up. So it's absolutely necessary. We also know that the likes of TikTok are taking a really central role in the music industry. And TikTok itself has just launched Sound On, which is its own version of representing music artists. So, you know, they're really going for it. And that's going to impact people like Spotify, and it's going to impact people like the music labels. So there's definitely a necessity. Do they need to directly copy the user experience and formats that are featured on platforms like TikTok? No, they don't. But, you know, I guess there's probably a lot of testing going on at the moment. We know that they launched Spotify Stories some time back. We know that they've launched other ways for artists to integrate and interact with audiences on the platform. So I think there's lots of really interesting stuff going on. I think for everyone's sake, we'd probably rather it doesn't turn into another copycat platform.
John, what do you think? Do you think that the TikTok effect is making other platforms maybe rethink their strategies?
Definitely. You know, we've seen Instagram bring in Reels, YouTube bringing in Shorts, which it's, you know, if not aping the user experience of TikTok, it's certainly taking what's on their platform and trying to make their own version of it. Tom's right, I think, in terms of, you know, Spotify needing to continue to innovate. They put a lot of money in podcasts. They've put a lot in audiobooks. And they are finding they have more and more competitors now, TikTok being one, because it is such a platform for discovery. I mean, we all know the user figures. We all know the issues around TikTok as well, in terms of whether they have legal action coming from both sides of the Atlantic. But what they do have is an awful lot of users who use it for a myriad different things. It's a search engine now. It is a discovery platform for music. I've got friends who work in record labels who have discussed with me about, you know, you need one person to put a song on the background of their TikTok video, and that could be all of a sudden 36 million listeners. It's crazy what that platform can do. I'm sure Tom has a lot more to say to that from Billion Dollar Boys side of things as well. I agree. It's this need for innovation, and I never mind seeing platforms change, but this homogenization across all of them, Instagram looking like Spotify, looking like Snapchat, looking like TikTok, it's not good. We need that differentiation. We need that space to offer different things. So I would not like to see it become a direct ripoff of TikTok, no.
Do you think that there's a possibility that, I suppose come to you, Tom, on this, that by Spotify kind of emulating TikTok's interface, it could be a blending of Spotify becoming more like a social media app despite not being one?
I think possibly. I mean, you see, there's a lot of evolution happening within the wider platform space in general. I mean, you look at YouTube, for example, you know, second biggest search engine in the world at the moment. Maybe TikTok will take that crown too. And, you know, they went from being the preeminent social media platform where all of the creators and influencers were, to pivoting their strategy to be pretty much all about search. And now they are desperately trying to claw back Being a social media platform, being somewhere, a destination that people go for community, for engagement. I think that there's absolutely a role that Spotify can play within that too. I don't think it's problematic for them to be looking to build community. I mean, you know, music is a thing that brings people together and people bond over and people feel extremely passionate about. So creating more elements within that ecosystem that enable conversation, engagement with artists, etc., I think will be welcomed by audiences and will provide plenty of opportunity for commercialization and brand partnerships too.
So just touching on that, the opportunity of brand partnerships, do you think that a move to try and emulate TikTok could well be profitable for Spotify? Do you think it will work out for them?
Definitely. I think it obviously ultimately depends on the different functionalities and formats that are built out and integrated into the platform. But, you know, say, imagine at the very basic level, there is a new For You page within Spotify. There's obviously plenty of opportunities within that for promoted videos, for actual advertisement in between scrolling. There's opportunity for creator partnerships where, you know, you get, I don't know, Lizzo to promote her. I think she's got a collaboration with Lululemon called Yitty, which, you know, could she do something around that that's targeted at her listeners on Spotify? There's so many opportunities, I think, within any platform to do that. And there's no reason Spotify couldn't be the next one.
John, any further thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, it's they're not strangers to innovation at Spotify. They will do interesting partnerships. You know, they have taken the Spurs shirt sponsorship for Barcelona, and they've put Drake's OVO logo on there. They've put Rosalía's new logo on the front of the shirts for different matches. They're not scared of pushing boundaries in terms of their partnerships and their creativity. I like that kind of innovation and seeing that go out there. And so I'd rather see more of that than them aping another platform. But yeah, I like Tom's point on community and music and community and why that's a natural fit. And, you know, I remember as a young person in my late teens being very active on Drowned in Sound message boards for alternative music and that community around it and going to gigs and stuff. And so building that for the 21st century for digital audience, it does go hand in hand. And I think that side of it could be really useful to Spotify. I'd like to see what they do.
Great. Fab. Well, I will take us on to our second part of the podcast, really, which is to speak to you a bit more in depth, Tom, about Billion Dollar Boy, about what you guys are about and what you're doing at the moment. So I think if you wouldn't mind starting just with a bit of a description about Billion Dollar Boy, where you've started and what you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So at Billion Dollar Boy, we talk about ourselves as creating advertising for the creator age. And for us, that constitutes three different areas and focuses. The first is creator marketing. The second is creator first advertising. And the third is the creator economy. And to delve into those into a little bit more detail, what we would term as creator marketing, some others may call influencer marketing. We prefer to use the word creator. And that is utilizing creators to create advertising that might live on their own social accounts, whatever account that might be, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, YouTube, you name it. Those assets might be utilized within brand socials. They might have some paid media spend behind them, predominantly on social. And it's kind of a traditional way of using creators. And a lot of brands are still within that space. And even the advanced brands still see a role for that type of activity. The second area, creator first advertising, is a approach to advertising in general, where you put creators at the fore, whether that be in front of the camera, behind the camera, or part of the development process. So you are not just social proofing an idea, you're creative proofing an idea, and you're utilizing their expertise and their understanding of audiences and communities to make sure that you are coming up with strategic and creative platforms, thoughts, ideas that are going to make real impact at all different stages of the funnel. And then the third area is the creator economy, which is wider and broader than advertising in general, and offers opportunities in a number of different areas, both in terms of partnering brands with creators, which was kind of what we've talked about, that is within the creator economy itself, but also provides the opportunity to sell services to creators and to create brands that you can then sell to consumers. You think of examples like Prime Energy and many others. So that's Billion Dollar Boy. That's the wider kind of context of what we're focused on. And we've been around since 2014. We started with YouTube partnerships. We've gone through Vine and Snapchat and all these different things. And now we're seeing the space evolve and grow faster than ever.
Yeah. Just touching upon your last point about, you've been around for close to a decade. How drastically has the landscape of creator marketing changed in this time?
I mean, enormously. And it's, when we started, we were lucky enough to have what was quite a rare relationship with YouTube at the time as a multi-channel network. I don't know if any of our listeners remember those. And YouTube was the predominant and a social platform. You remember kind of the Brit pack of YouTubers that sort of dominated focus and attention, both from marketers, but also from consumers. And that, as I say, then evolved into Vine, which was a bit of a blip, unfortunately, as much as I love the platform. But now we have TikTok, which is kind of the same thing. So yes, it's evolved enormously, and especially in regards to the kind of commercial opportunities within the space and the acceptance of brands and the wider advertising industry that this is a real field. Certainly earlier on in our growth, there were plenty that didn't see this space as being, a real thing or like here to last, I suppose. But that really all changed during the pandemic. So it's evolved massively.
Amazing. And are you seeing any particular trends in the industry at the moment, particularly in the aftermath of the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the integration of talent and the willingness to integrate talent into the heart of a idea, into the heart of a media plan is something that's happening more and more. I was discussing with our global creative director earlier this morning that I was watching TV the other day and saw two spots for Garnier during the ad break, both of which basically only featured creators talking to camera. And I just thought that was incredible, because even a year ago, you look at a brand like that and they were using sort of centrally created assets that created globally in Paris or something like that. And now all of their TV advertising and all of their wider advertising in general features creators front and center, and beauty and grooming and wellness have always been at the forefront of innovation within advertising anyway. So it was just quite remarkable to see for me. So I think that's a big trend that we're going to see more of. We are experimenting ourselves with similar approaches with some of the brands that we work with Unilever. We just did a big launch in Australia for Lipton Iced Tea, which featured a creator front and center. We took over the biggest billboard in Australia, 28 meters high in Melbourne, had experiential activity on the ground, sampling on the ground, and there was a big uplift in sales as a result across the country. So that's a big trend, and there are obviously plenty of others.
Sounds like some really fantastic projects. Where do you think, if you could predict where the space is headed at the moment? It sounds like it's in quite a revolutionary stage now. Do you have any predictions for the near future?
Yes. Where to start? I think aside from the integration point, I think there is going to be, we're seeing a rapid growth in the number of creators out there, the different types of creators, the different types of businesses that are leaning on this kind of ability to reach or build audiences organically, and that kind of democratization of creativity. So we're seeing a lot of independent businesses jump into the space, which is really exciting to see, like craftsmen and craftspeople benefit from these opportunities that platforms provide. We want to help facilitate that and help those businesses understand how they can grow and turn into the next kind of big thing. I think there's, ultimately, as we see the kind of the top of the pyramid, I suppose, get bigger and more influential, you start to create, enormous celebrities from grassroots, whether that be KSI and the Sidemen or Logan Paul, or whether that be Amelia de Moldenberg and Chicken Shop Dates. Her videos have 4 million views on average. That is enormous. I know a lot of entertainment businesses are now looking at these opportunities and trying to figure out, well, okay, how do we evolve now? How do we get involved in kind of the content format game on YouTube, for example? And I think you'll see a lot of brands in particular start to think, okay, we need to be testing co-creation of brands themselves or products themselves, rather than just thinking about, oh, well, we're going to pay them to feature in this, in X or Y. Because when it comes to that big size talent where they have a very diversified revenue stream, appearing in a one-off commercial is not interesting to them anymore.
We had a discussion on the pod a while back when it's interesting that you've mentioned Australia, because they were talking about regulating the influencer marketing industry and, in terms of hashtag paid posts or that kind of thing, making sure that people are aware when this person is a paid influencer for a brand. Is that something that might, tamper this gold rush that we're seeing in influencer marketing, or do you see that as an essential to make sure it's legitimized as part of like an omni-channel strategy?
Yeah, I mean, there are, as with every industry, there are, some bad actors. There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of creators out there, depending on how you define them. There are some that are not fully educated on the regulations in place, and there are some that just intentionally ignore them, and that includes brands too. It is a heavily regulated space already in most markets. I think that's one thing that people are unaware of. The ASA has been ruling on this kind of thing and providing guidance on this kind of thing since we started in 2014, and perhaps even earlier. Australia has its own approach. All markets have their own approach. We know also, for example, that the French government is currently working through proposals for 11 different measures around this industry and space, officially defining various things like what an influencer is. And those are being looked at very closely by the European Commission. And it might be that the European Commission decides to take the approach that they will adopt these same criteria. So it's evolving. I think that to an extent, creators are held to a higher level of account than some other industries, which is not particularly fair. But it's a new industry, and things will continue to evolve and hopefully become a lot clearer for everyone within the space as we go.
So that brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And John, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Always a pleasure, Shears.
Wonderful. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next time.